Well, that's kind of our feeling, our guess, maybe Keith Rowland's feeling for what it would be like if you were on the spacecraft and listening to it doing all its clicks and wells and bissels and various sprockets turning and cameras whirring. And in other words, you have to do all this in your imagination because there's no signal from the spacecraft. And I did not hear one reporter ask anybody, why are we in this blackout? I mean, we could have 8 1/3 bits per second from Mars, from Mariner 4, incredibly simple and relatively unsophisticated gadget compared to this spacecraft. And if we're getting 4,000 bits per second when they're really lined up on the high gain, why couldn't we have a few bits per second of engineering data? I still find this a stunning gap in our knowledge as to why this mission was designed this way. But be that as it may, Richard Grossinger, have you got any thoughts?
You have a lot more experience with this kind of thing than most of those people, if not all of those people asking questions. So I don't think it occurred to them to ask.
Oh, well.
Yeah.
At some point, maybe this evening, I'll get a chance to ask. By the way, we're going to do some live programming. I'm going to be back on the Dark Matter Network tonight, I believe in the 7 o'clock Pacific hour. To give everybody an update as to the phone home signal and some of the new imagery and all that. So you might want to tune back into DMDN later this evening at 7 o'clock Pacific, which would be, 10 o'clock Eastern. That kind of gives you a bracket. Any of you guys want to join me, or am I on my own on this?
Rich, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Yeah, I've got Bill Nye online.
Oh,
cool. Push that button. It should say mute off. Just push it once. Hang on. Hello?
Bill.
Yeah, hold on. It's there. Greetings. Let's walk
Mr.
over
Nye.
Here.
Mr. Science Guy, you got a bunch of us turning blue, as they said on Apollo many decades ago. Give us your impressions. What do you think?
Oh, it's fantastic. You know, I was in Senator Barbara Mikulski's office in the year 2000.
Let me stop you there. I spent a New Year's night in 1973 or 4 on a rooftop over Times Square with Barbara Mikulski just as she was being appointed to chair that committee. Go.
So some years later, I took some, we had 10,000 10,000 postcards from Planetary Society members. Planetary Society was started by Carl Sagan.
And Bruce
Murray, who was the head of the Jet Propulsion Lab during the Voyager missions and Viking missions to Mars. The Viking went to Mars, Voyager's on the way out of the solar system now, both of them.
Yep.
Reminding or encouraging Ms. Mikulski to support a mission to Pluto. And that was in 2000, the year 2000. And then, sure enough, 6 years later, it launched. I was at Cape Canaveral. It was January 19th, 2006. 9.5 years.
Isn't that astonishing?
Get to Pluto. There's a lot of space in space. And when it left Earth, it was the fastest rocket ever launched.
Yes, I we've gone over that this morning. Let me ask you a couple of interesting technical questions. Why did not we have an Omni beacon antenna system on the spacecraft so we could track it all the way through this encounter, like Mariner 4? That was 8 1/3 bits per second 50 years ago.
Mariner 4 was 1.5 astronomical units away.
Okay.
1.5 Earth orbits. This is closer to 30. And
yeah, it's about 13,000 times the distance to the moon.
But in other words, it gets to be a very difficult problem.
Well, the old inverse square law, why couldn't we have a few bits per second?
And why don't they have windshield wipers on those Mars rovers?
In
other words, it's a very difficult problem. You're already into the thing 9.5 years. You can wait another, I believe the thinking is you can wait another few hours.
Yeah, I
can see the images. Yeah.
But with all the encounters we've gone through, you know, you've covered many of them as I have. They've all had, you know, Omni antennas, so we got at least very low bitrate engineering data to let us know this thing is still doing what it's doing. Like if something happened and we didn't have any data, we will never know what happened to this thing.
Well, you may be right, But keep in mind that they did four large downloads of so-called fail-safe data already in the unlikely event that it did get hit by some debris in the Plutonian system there. So I understand what you're driving at, but people have given that very question a lot of deep thought. I was not an engineer on this mission, but I'm sympathetic to the problems that they had, that they faced. So they've downloaded four sets of fail-safe data, and it is strongly believed that at 9 o'clock tonight they will have all these extraordinary 10 times the resolution color images.
Mm. What is your impression of that image?
It's fantastic. I mean, the big thing that always that I just can't get over is how round it is. How much gravity you need to be a sphere. You know, you think about, when I think about asteroids and other planetary, like Ceres, for example, other planetary bodies that are enormous, you have to reach a certain size to have to be so-called hydrostatically spherical.
Yeah, I think that's around 250 miles, if I remember correctly.
Well, anyway, this thing is that big. And it looks like it has snow. It has snow made of methane, of natural gas and nitrogen. It's very much out of your everyday experience. But the science or the physics of it is just like we have elsewhere in the solar system. So it's just amazing. It's an amazing place.
Now, Stern was answering a question about going back, and he actually sounded like he really expects we're going to get landers maybe in our lifetime. Do you think that's realistic?
Well, certainly realistic and affordable, but we have, changing the subject to science writ large, we have so much anti-science, so many people who are against science generally, that it's not clear if we can do this. The fabulous thing about space exploration is it brings out the best in us from both sides of the aisle. And so this would be an example of what you can do for less than $1 billion spent over 15 years.
Over 15 years. Yeah, it's about $700 million.
Way less than a cup of coffee.
Yep.
Way less. And so this is the extraordinary things you can do. And I always talk about the two questions. The two questions that we've all wondered. And if you meet somebody who says, I've never asked those questions, they're lying to you. Where did we all come from?
Yes.
And then, are we alone in the universe? And if you want to answer those two questions, you have to explore space. And Pluto is part of that. Learning about how planets work, how the chemistry of planets behaves, informs us writ large about science writ large.
Go ahead, guys.
Bill's got some other interviews to do.
Yeah. There's so many people running around. It's a very
Bill,
exciting.
I am so grateful you gave us a few minutes. I had one more question.
I'm just trying to change the world. Your last question, here you go.
Where do you stand on the is Pluto a planet controversy?
Oh, well, I don't mind Pluto being a planet, but I don't mind it. I don't have a big issue with being a dwarf planet. As you may know, I have advocated for the third solar system. The first one being the terrestrial planets.
Right.
Then the second one being the gas giants.
Yep.
Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune. And then this would be the first of a new class of objects we would call the Plutoids.
Mm.
So the way to get around this problem, you know, birds are flying around and they're dinosaurs. Birds are dinosaurs, okay?
Absolutely.
But they're not the ancient dinosaurs. Pluto can be a planet, but it's not one of the eight traditional planets. I'm okay with that, too.
Okay.
But I like the word Plutoid, but I'll let you guys fist it out.
Hey, thanks a lot, Bill. Have fun.
Carry on. Let's change the worlds. Here
We're
you
trying.
Go.
All right, Rich.
Thank you, Keith. If you can find Dennis for us while we switch to, I want to bring in Keith Laney, who's been very patiently sitting by his computer and looking at these images. I want some imaging inferences from what we've got. Are you there, Keith?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, my gosh. We've got too many Keiths and too many Richards. Go ahead, Keith Laney.
First of all, let me
give you a little intro. Keith Laney is an imaging expert. He runs a really amazing website called Hidden Mission.com. he has been analyzing and processing using commercial and other tools the imagery that we get from all the space agencies, NASA, ESA, the Russians, the Japanese, etc. And he produces some phenomenally bona fide work. You've had a few minutes now to look at this latest release. What are your impressions?
Well, frankly, I'm surprised we're getting good imagery like this on a start out. We know historically that, you know, they tend to give us some washed out stuff or try to pull some stuff on us with first images normally. I'm not really seeing that with this. The image itself is a fairly good quality for a, you know, for what it is and for where the spacecraft was positioning. I see a lot of linearities on the surface, which are really nice for us because we really like those linearities. the overall color is, you know, I wish they could have probably done a better job on the color, but we know how they do color imaging with the overlaying of the channels and the selection of what bands they use to determine what colors we actually get to see. So, you know, we know that true color imagery is really just a figure that they've pulled out of the air. You know, it's just true color. Well, what is true color? But it's pretty well represented here. This is a pretty amazing image that we're looking at. It's got a pretty good bit of detail in it, and I just really can't wait to see the higher resolution versions.
Well, tonight you heard him say that we're going to get images that will be what 10 to 100 times better than what we're seeing now as they do a strip across that that heart shaped area in the front of the disc.
Mm-hmm. Now are they convinced? I mean, I heard Bill Nye say, you know, I mean, seeing ice, is he maybe referring to the heart being ice?
I think he was referring to the discussion yesterday at the press conference where they've got nitrogen ice at the poles.
Yes.
But we don't know what that white thing is at the equator, which is that big. To me, it looks much more geometric. It looks like a square tipped on its on one edge, on one point.
You know, shades of Iapetus here, man.
Yeah, exactly.
So you know, I've heard it say it's. I've heard it mentioned many times that it's very akin to maybe Triton. You know, but I'm seeing Iapetus. You remember the when we got those first images of Iapetus and all the linearities that we saw on the ground around it, looking, gosh, every bit like arcology.
Are you talking about Voyager stuff or from Cassini?
From Cassini.
Cassini is the current mission for those that aren't following space too closely. It's a bus-sized spacecraft, unmanned, sent up, you know, 10 years, 15 years ago. It's been orbiting Cassini ever since Saturn ever since 2004, and it's sent us some stunning things, including close-ups of Iapetus, which is that weird outer moon that I've written a great deal about on Enterprise Mission. But, yeah, you see analogies to the terrain we see on Iapetus here on Pluto.
Yes, that's exactly what I see. And I sure wish that we could see that other side with those great big gaping basins or holes whatever they are.
Now, those will have rotated around during this flyby. In fact, I'm looking at NASA Select, which is the NASA TV channel. I have a TV monitor here in the studio, and I'm looking at their automated computer profile. They're now looking back at the sun. They're looking at the crescent Pluto. And they're looking at Charon, and what they're doing is they're photographing the night side of Pluto, as Stern said, by the light of the sun reflected off Charon, which is half the size of Pluto, 12,000 miles away, so it provides a big reflector in the sky on the hidden hemisphere, and we may get, depending upon the signal to noise, some very interesting data, not only on the night side of Pluto, but also as those big four regions, the size of the state of Minnesota, rotate around, we might get a close-up, better high-res view of those by Pluto and Charon light.
Well, that would really be nice. It would also be amazing if we had something that was glowing on the backside, sort of like Ceres.
What's that? Dick, have you got any questions?
Well, no. I feel out of the picture here because I don't have access to the photographs that Keith is talking about, so I haven't seen them.
Yeah,
how far out was the spacecraft when that photograph that you're discussing was taken?
I think, Keith, correct me if I'm wrong, Keith Laney, but I think about 500,000 miles.
Yes, he said somewhere around 4 kilometers per pixel.
Okay. So that translates out to about 500,000. In other words, twice the distance to our moon.
Yeah, well, you can imagine the quality, if in fact we get them, the quality of the pictures that were taken at 7,800 miles from the surface an hour ago.
Yeah, 7,750 plus or minus. Yep. A lot of sevens in that. More symbology, Richard.
It's always there.
It's always there.
In every mission. I started out, Richard, looking at that and going, nah, that's just coincidental. But it's not. It's in everyone.
You mean the overtones of this background symbology?
Mm-hmm. The 19.5s, the 33s, the 77s. All the sacred numbers, they're all there. And, you know, that's not just coincidental.
My contention is that NASA is doing this deliberately because they're trying to do magic. They're basically doing sympathetic magic, you know, tweaking the force, trying to manipulate the torsion field by resonance of activity on certain dates and numbers and times and synchronous revolutions and all that. And, you know, Richard Grossinger, our anthropologist, gently disagrees with me, and he says this is more part of the fabric of reality itself and that nobody actually has to be doing this. And I just see so many instances where it is too cute for...
Yeah, I think you're turning civilians into shamans.
Well, is it a rabbit's foot or a ritual?
That's an interesting...
Well, if it's a ritual, whose ritual?
Well, remember, there are a whole bunch of Masons that ran NASA in its early years, and we don't know how many people are there that are part of that, you know, fraternal order, who actually have a belief system which is a little different than most people walking around in America's Masons.
But I don't think that in contemporary times that the old Masonic system translates through the Rosicrucian Theosophical Masonic system. I think it's become somewhat empty ritual, and if anything, is more social and political now than it is metaphysical or esoteric. And I think all of that information resides in completely other areas that NASA has no access to. So, but I'm not adamant or like it's not an issue. I'm not going to be dogmatic about it. I really like Richard's take on things, and I think that the way he sees things opens up really important avenues beyond whether he's literally correct or not.
Is that called having your cake and eating it too?
No, not at all. Because I think I mean, I know you're being a little bit facetious, but I think the whole point of anything really important is that we do have our cake and eat it too, and it's our refusal to do that that gets us in so many of the problems we're in.
Well, if as I have proposed, going back now many years, there is another side to this physics, there is a technology, then I think it would behoove us to look at those folks that appear to be using these symbols in a way to tweak that physics, because it's more physics and more malleable than dealing with the normal laboratory EM stuff that we do every day and that has built our society and our civilization. This is a higher order. This is the physics underneath the astrology. It's hyperdimensional astrology, if you will.
Right. I just don't believe those people are doing it, but I do believe that there are people on this planet and on this plane that are doing stuff like that. And I think that I just don't think that they're at NASA. But wait.
If you have evidence, think of this as a court case. You have circumstantial evidence.
It's circumstantial.
That an institution, and there are people who have died under circumstantial evidence,
right,
have been convicted.
True.
Yeah. So we're looking at NASA as an institution. Laney corresponds to my observation that there's this redundant, overwhelmingly repetitive set of patterns that show up around all of these missions. And you're saying it's part of the furniture, and I'm saying somebody is consciously doing this, setting it up, and you're saying they don't know enough to set it up, and I say we don't know the right people.
Yeah, and neither of us has the authority to answer this question. But, you know, it's worth going back to the original Jung-Pauli discussion, psychologist and physicist, on synchronicity. And just, you know, reading the Princeton University Press book, I think it's called Atom and Archetype, that really dig into just how deep synchronicity can be. I put it in the night sky in my chapter on astrology, when I was trying to really hit at a synchronicity which would embrace kind of both Einstein and Jung. And I think that I'm not being judgmental here. I just don't think you're operating at the level of depth that that can get to. And at the same time, I think you're esoterically inflating NASA into something that it's not. I think that they're a bunch of civilians, as I said. I don't think that esoterically they're civilians. And you know, you were asking me before, what's my impression now? And I think my main impression is the seeds have been sown now. The seeds of Pluto are being sown now on the Earth and in Earth consciousness. And that includes, you know, things like Keith's, what Keith is going to do with the imagery and purely scientific analysis of it, and then all the symbolic ramifications and what people will make of it, and the other events happening with Greece and Iran today, and everything else, it'll all swirl around in the vortex, and we will be changed. But the fact that we not only have Pluto as a remote, mute kind of object that we now have, that it's now suddenly in our midst in this really palpable way, is going to have implications archetypally. And you're saying, well, yeah, but there actually is a strategy, a conscious strategy that's being played out by individuals. And that may be true. I don't know that we're ever going to know that. It's interesting, and one would be a naive not to take that into account and to try and handicap it in some way. And that's why I think no view, and I really mean this seriously from the most objective, neutral standpoint, I don't think you can write 20th and 21st century astronomy without Richard Hoagland's view. Even if you are a complete skeptic and debunker of him, I think that you omit his view totally at your loss and peril. And I've thought that continuously since Dick and I first met in Oakland in 85 or 86.
Mm. And I think it was earlier.
I think it was
82 or 83, probably 83.
No, it wasn't that. Well, okay, I'll concede that it could have been. But my point is, Dick's gone off on tangents that I've questioned many times, but I've never questioned the core vision. The core vision has integrity and clarity, and so when you speak and I say, well, I don't really think that this is what NASA personnel are doing, I say that while recognizing on another level, through a glass darkly, you are seeing the current epic correctly. But I think it's through a glass darkly, and you think you're looking through a real glass. That's the difference.
Well, the art form is to separate the archetypal from the physically reproducible. I mean, science is supposed to be something where you do experiments and then you figure out.
Otherwise, why even send a satellite to? Why even send out New Horizons? Why not just go into internal space and imagine Pluto? Real value. We are manifesting in the physical plane, not the etheric or the astral plane, and the universe is asking us to carry out activities in the physical plane. if it wasn't doing that, and I don't mean to be anthropomorphic here, but if there weren't a drive to carry out physical activities, there wouldn't be a physical plane, and we wouldn't have the urgencies and desires and agendas and ambitions we do. Collectively, we have a big agenda in the physical plane, and that there's no reason to downplay that, and that minimize it. And at the same time, that's not the indication that there aren't other planes and a bigger picture. And Keith is writing away here.
I was going to say, Keith, you want to jump in on this?
Yeah, you're talking about archetypical Pluto. Pluto's associated with like I read out there. It's the principle of elemental power, depth, and intensity, almost an overpowering intensity, and it's associated with all the mythological principles, and all the destructive gods, Kali, Shiva, the Quetzalcoatl, you name it. Pluto is a symbol in that method, so you can base whatever you're pulling off of this to that frame of reference.
Well, see, I'm
but
asking.
Pluto also stands for death before rebirth.
And right, regenerative power.
Regenerative power, transmigration, and essentially, you know, Pluto means the wealth. It comes from the original Greek word for wealth, but it means real wealth, not superficial riches.
I like this, and violet purgatorial discharge of pent-up energies.
Mm-hmm. Well, remember, the Pluto is the god of the underworld. The underworld that he's supposed to be ruling is Hades, and the idea of Pluto looking underground, that's where minerals are, that's where, you know, things that we make things out of can be mined. So the idea of connecting Pluto with wealth is that the physical reality of making life better is to take the stuff out of the ground, from underground, and make it into something, add value, and so you are more wealthy if you do that. There's a whole linkage of symbolic association.
Pluto says, my job is, now that you've done that, is to wipe it out so that you realize that it's not real.
Mm-hmm. That's kind of
then you have to change. Pluto's goal, you know, symbolically and astrologically, is to bring you to absolute despair, where there's no hope in anything. And mm-hmm. then when you've reached that point, then there's a new beginning.
Okay, look, we got about half an hour to do an interesting overview and a wrap on what we've seen this morning. I'd like to bring in a surprise guest. I need to go away and find this surprise guest, so we're going to go to a break,
Rich,
now at the bottom of the hour. Yes?
Yeah, I found Bill Overby.
Dennis Overby. Okay.
Okay. You're Bill Overby or Dennis Overby?
It's Dennis.
Dennis. Yeah, I got him. I found him. Are we going to go to break now?
Let's go to break, and then when we come back, we'll take Dennis at the right after we come back. Okay, is Keith Morgan available?
Yes, Rich. I've got Dennis here, and you can interview him now.
Okay. Dennis, can you hear me?
Yes, Rich, I think I can hear you.
Okay.
How are you? Are you here? Oh, no, you're in California or something like that.
No, I'm in New Mexico. Our control center is in Arizona. We have correspondents outside D.C. We have people from Maine. You know, social media has made these encounters very different than what you and I used to experience.
Yeah, social media is going bonkers this morning.
I can well imagine. So what do you think? Give me a big picture. How does this hit you compared to what we've seen before?
Well, it hits me as the end of an era.
Yep.
Or
yep.
Maybe breaking out of the cocoon at last, but New Horizons is out of the cocoon. Where it goes, maybe someday we'll follow.
I was intrigued that Stern seemed very bullish on the idea of a mission to orbit and even land within our lifetime, within the next, you know, let's say decade or so?
I don't think, well, he knows more about the situation than I do. I don't expect to see anything going back out there in my lifetime, but I could be wrong.
Well, aren't CubeSats now going interplanetary in the next year or so? CubeSats are these, for those who don't know, are these democratized payloads that NASA provides to students and experimenters to get into space really cheap.
Yeah, they're really great things. Now, I don't actually know that they're going interplanetary. You can't go interplanetary all by yourself. I guess a CubeSat could pitch a ride on something that was going farther.
I think that's the idea, because the typical CubeSat launches now on piggyback on a mission into Earth orbit. But
right.
Yeah, they're talking about putting two or three of them together so you have power and you have an antenna. And if they went to lasers, they would have a higher bit rate, you know, based on the Laddie demo. And I mean, there are all kinds of things that might be done privately. Look at what Musk is doing with his efforts.
He's amazing.
Isn't he?
Very interesting guy, Elon, yeah.
When was the last time you talked to him? Have you ever sat down and had that big vision conversation about where he's going, where he thinks he's going?
No, I don't know him that well. I was at a dinner with him once a couple
of years ago. Would you like to talk to him?
It was his next big ambition was to create thermonuclear power.
Really?
And I said, well, that's been everybody's dream for a long time, but I don't want to be the one to talk you out of trying to do it, because I wouldn't want to try to talk him out of anything. So it's been a very hectic, emotional day here, I think, and will be tonight when the spacecraft phones home and they know for sure
now,
that
check my memory, but in all of the missions that I've covered, I don't know about you, but all the missions I've covered, even through Voyager and Neptune and all that, we had a signal all the way through the encounter period. At least we had engineering to tell us things were happening the way they should. This, I think, is the first NASA mission ever to where you deliberately have like 24 hours where nobody hears anything and you're just basically praying that it all is going according to the computer plan. Isn't that kind of unusual?
I'm sure that your memory and knowledge of this is much better than mine. But I do know, you know, every Apollo mission, they went around the moon and we didn't know if they were coming back.
Well, but that's because of physical. You're not in interstellar space or interplanetary space where you have line of sight. I mean, during an encounter, you have line of sight. So apart from occultations, for instance, Mariner 4 spent, I think, 30, 40 minutes in Mars shadow deliberately to measure Dick Bertel, as you asked me that night 50 years ago, the properties of the atmosphere by bending the spacecraft radio beam through the atmosphere back to the Earth antennas. On this mission, they reversed that. They've sent a very complex signal from the ground antennas up to the spacecraft 4.5 hours out, and the spacecraft was turned around to receive that information as it comes filtered through Pluto's atmosphere.
Right.
But even though you're
right, that signal is on its way.
Yeah, and even though the spacecraft is aimed and looking at Earth and it's picking up that signal, they couldn't multiplex a signal down during the occultations to say, hey, I'm still alive. I don't understand the engineering. It makes no sense to me. Because engineers love enough data to tell what happened if everything goes, you know, if it hits the fan.
Well, I can't answer that. I don't know enough about the details.
If I ask enough people,
Horizons, I do
find
think
out.
It was, you know, it was designed to be as simple as a spacecraft as possible. No scan platforms that could jam the way Voyagers did, going past Saturn, as I recall. And
yep, that was Voyager 2. That was an eerie morning. We were all gathered down in the press room. We're looking at the monitors, expecting to see pictures, and we see blank space, and we knew something was off.
Well, if you think about it, I'm much you've been around this business a longer than I have been, but it seems to me Close Encounter days have always been pretty interesting and often traumatic. Certainly the Uranus encounter was the same day as the Challenger explosion.
Yes, that was tragic.
Neptune, Dan Quayle decided to visit JPL that day.
I was not there. I was in Virginia watching on a...
Right into everybody's lives. Everybody had to get new press badges. And
oh, my gosh.
Like, yeah, it was like, yeah, for...
So you think this could be the last encounter, kind of, more or less?
Well, I think...
For a very long time.
Of the worlds that we know about. I mean, that New Horizons looks like it's going to go on. It'll visit a couple more Kuiper Belt objects.
Yes.
I think that,
it's
RPGs are good until like 2030 or something like that. So it can go a long ways and still do science.
Well, the interesting thing here is that we're going to have really high quality, amazing data streaming in now for 16 months, because this is such a slow motion deal.
Yeah.
That every week or every month, it's going to be like we're doing this all over again with brand new close up stuff.
I think we'll get most of the real close up stuff pretty quickly, but then the real fun begins when they go to work on it and stretching the pictures and enhancing them and overlaying them with other data. So,
well, Dennis, I certainly appreciate you dropping by and taking a few minutes here and comparing notes on what it used to be and what it is now. I mean, the world with social media is changing in all directions, including NASA encounters.
It really, is. I've been mostly just tweeting things this morning, and every tweet I tweet, it gets retweeted a zillion times, and Twitter is so slow now that I can't even get on it.
Well, it's a far cry from the from the mission that Dick and I covered 50 years ago. A far cry.
Yeah.
Anybody else have any questions before we let Mr. Overby gently go back to the party?
I'm out of questions, so I'm going to pass.
Okay, Richard.
Nope.
Okay.
Okay, Dennis. Thank you so much, and have fun.
Thank you. Nice talking to you.
Same here.
Bye.
So let us bring in now our surprise guest. Keith, can we do that?
Which Keith are you talking to now?
The Keith Rowland, who's running Mission Control for us back in Mesa.
Oh, okay.
So we are all lined up here. Surprise guest, can you say a few words?
Good morning. I see that there have been very exciting events taking place at 3:30 in the morning that challenged everybody.
Yeah, this is Dr. Robin Falkoff. You know everybody on the panel, Keith Laney and Dick Bertel and Richard Grossinger and Keith Rowland at the Mission Control. Keith Morgan.
Good morning, Robin.
Good morning, guys. Good morning. What a night you've had, and what an event this has been for you all. I can't wait to hear all about it.
Well, I'm sure Dick is going to fill you in on the details.
Well, what I'm going to do after our program here is I'm going to segue over and I'm going to do a few minutes on Robin's show. Robin has a two-hour show that comes up right when we go off the air at the top of the hour. So, Robin, if you want to promo your show, there's a lot of folks listening that I'm sure would like to catch part of our conversation. So,
Certainly. Well, I've sent out a whole bunch of announcements, and for this audience, you are welcome to head on over and join us on Event Horizons. It airs Monday through Friday from 10 a.m. to noon, and you find the show online as well. We've been there 5 years at freedomslips.com, and we are in Studio A. And that'll be starting at 8 a.m. in just a few minutes.
Dick, as we wrap up here, given this half-century perspective and given the fact that all of this we put together kind of on a shoestring, and it's only possible because of the technologies we have at our fingertips now, what are your kind of big-picture thoughts on where we are?
Well, of course, this is mind-blowing for me because I've been retired for 10 years now, and I've never been involved in something like this before. And I think that, it obviously indicates that we're going to be able to communicate in even more broad terms in the future to people. We're using media that we didn't even conceive of 50 years ago.
Well, you know, one of the things that occurs to me is if you look at the track record of NASA spending research and development monies to develop all this technology, what most people are not aware is that that technology has now filtered out over a half century into the general society. In other words, without NASA doing what it did 50 years ago and all the other missions, the developments that have made smartphones and tablets and satellite communication and fiber optics and all of the ways the world is now knitted together, all the ways that people can form community, that's one of Robin's big things is community, people talking to each other and getting things done without the intervening filters. You don't have to go to City Hall. You can talk to people at the grassroots level and get all kinds of things done. That kind of technology that made possible our program this morning is directly made possible by the investment in R&D that NASA has put before us over the last half century.
Absolutely, yes. There's no question about that.
Richard Grossinger, any thoughts?
You mean we're concluding gradually, aren't we, coming to a close?
Yeah, we're coming.
I just think, you know, that we have our eyes open going forward to see how this event emerges at all different levels. The anthology that we did and that Dick Hoagland played such a huge part in is a good program guide.
You mean the Pluto New Horizons for Lost Horizons?
Yeah, Pluto New Horizons for Lost Horizon, which is the astronomy, astrology, and mythology of Pluto. It's a good primer and guide to the event. It's like your program to the event. But from here, it's a whole new ball game and a whole different Pluto and will emerge and hopefully at a deep symbolic level, whole new Plutonian influences will arise from the culture synchronously with this, because as we've noted, we've seen plenty of synchronicities.
So, I just was so struck, you know, when I was trying to get Overby to address it, and I guess he wasn't privy to the interview that Stern did with us where he basically said, Pluto is more interesting than Mars. That's an amazing statement.
Yep.
Yeah,
amazing statement.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean. It continues to resonate. You keep going back to it. And also this mini solar system, this meta solar system out
there. See, to me, when I did that chapter, when I started getting into the research, and as you know, it took, 6-8 months to actually deliver? Mm-hmm. I was doing a lot of research into the system, and Pluto... If you look at the physics and you look at planets as hyperdimensional resonant generators, that they are creating, you know, tremors in the force.
Otherwise, it shouldn't be there.
The way that Pluto goes around Charon and Charon goes around Pluto, both of them like an egg beater, with the other little moons, 30, 40 miles across, orbiting farther out around the two of them, that creates such beats and resonances in the physics. And I know this because we've been able to, with the Accutron system, detect those celestial alignments and those celestial torsion modulations in other totally different contexts, like during the eclipse that Robin and I surveyed from the top of the Sandia Mountains that are out my window here as the morning has broken over the great American southwestern deserts of New Mexico. At that altitude, sitting on all that limestone, the resonance between the Accutron detector actually picking up the fields from the sun and the moon as they were lined up in the eclipse is obvious, and actually some of that data is published in that chapter in New Horizons for a Lost Horizon. That geometry, placing a spacecraft in an artificial eclipse so that it can look at the sun through Pluto, at the sun through Charon at the Earth through Pluto and the Earth through Charon with a detector system on that spacecraft as it moves through those two eclipses seems to me so provident as a way to measure the unseen torsion field effects that we know are there, but we don't know because no one's ever published if the New Horizons team is actually taking data looking at that part.
Yeah, glimmers of Einstein and Mercury.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, maybe Alan will be honest with us and later on will admit that there's tools and instrumentation on the spacecraft that can pick this up.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Or maybe not.
Maybe not.
Remember, to me, Pluto represents kind of an apocalypse symbolically. And apocalypse does not mean catastrophe. It means enlightenment. It means when secrets are no longer kept. Mm-hmm. Keith Laney, are you around?
Sure, I am.
Okay.
I was about to quote that apocalypse means revelation.
And then you were saying there's a trend curve in these images where you expected them to get fuzzy and unclear, and they're not proceeding down that path. The images are clear and sharp and revealing.
Right. And I have been floored. The images that we got that we've been getting from Ceres, the images that we are getting from Pluto, it's no wonder that NASA shut everything down real quick out of fear. And that's exactly what they did the other day. They got both probes, shut them down. Hold on a minute, you guys. And that's exactly what went on.
Now, wait. Back up. You're saying that they themselves shut the computers down?
Oh, I'm sure. Look at the images.
Hang on. So is it not also possible that someone did that outside of NASA as a warning?
Yes.
Not to proceed?
Someone we don't know. It's just obvious that you know, you look at cause and effect. That's what we had. Look what Ceres had been showing us. Come on, man, the great big pyramid that looks so much like South Massive on the moon. The bright spots that glow in the dark.
At 19.5, remember?
Exactly, at 19.5.
Okay,
yes.
Richard, since you're our resident coincidence factor this morning, let me run this one by you. 2 weeks about a week ago, within a few hours of each other, we had two computer problems on two separate NASA spacecraft orbiting two separate worlds, one orbiting the Dawn spacecraft orbiting Ceres, the large asteroid, the dwarf planet, and one approaching Pluto, the other dwarf planet, and both of them within hours suffered computer problems that could have, in fact, ended their missions. And is that the pattern? Is that coincidence?
No,
or is that
very strange. I don't know.
The common denominator being both of them returning astounding, mind-shattering images.
Yes, before their event, and now with Pluto.
I say go with the guy with the energy, and Keith's got the energy.
Well, I mean, when I looked at this, we were all sitting here. This is our love. We were sitting here watching this go on. I had my eyes wide open watching both, and to have both of them shut down. I mean, I chronicled it on my message board, but it was very amazing. The pictures that came back, and then the shutdown, and then the explanations for what happened in various places or outlets for disinformation, I like to call them, on the web, that have an official teaching.
Kubrick's post 2001 movie Eyes Wide Shut.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it's, you know, it was covered for, and yes, I had a convenient explanation because they always do. But I think New Horizons overcame this because, honestly, I mean, and I have no proof of this, but I think that's a little something to this turn it all off and let it do its own thing while it's going, because how can that be shut down from the ground? When they came back online, they were jubilant. Something had happened. And now they might be a muted version now. What we're getting to see might have to be muted a little bit, but now it's too late.
And I this think has to, go ahead.
It has to go with the archetypical transformational power of Pluto.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Archetypally, I think we're at the demarcation between things kept hidden and things to be revealed. And I think this mission is at the front of a new NASA, if I can say that, you know, with a straight face, where actually we're now going to finally be seeing things that have been hidden for, well, Dick, for 50 years.
Well, certainly we're seeing things today that we never dreamed possible 50 years ago.
Okay, we got a few minutes to
well,
the top of the hour.
They can't defeat Pluto.
Let me just go in order here. Grossinger, take it first, then Dick, then Robin, then Keith, and then I'll wrap up. What are our final thoughts before we close out the show?
Richard? What are our final thoughts? I'm still kind of relating to the different buzzes that people have and the energy. And I think that we've said what there is to say, both in our talking and then before that in the book. And I think I just go with the energy at this point. Like I said, Keith had the energy there for a moment. And try not to pin anything down, but just say, boy, there's a whole lot of energy being generated by Pluto now on many levels, not just as an interdimensional machine, but as whatever you want to call it, an archetypal seed, a kind of mean motion resonance implant in our system of consciousness. So let's just see where it goes. And if you want me to join you at 10, I will. Just let me know.
Okay.
Down the road. Okay.
Yeah, we'll do all that housekeeping when we get off the air, because there are obviously going to be some new things added. Why don't we go to Keith Morgan? Keith, what are your final thoughts?
I'm stoked at the technology that I used, and it pulled it off really well. I used deck headsets that had a 500-foot range, sort of like Bluetooth, but they're at 1.59 gigahertz, and I was able to walk around here and hand person people the headsets, and they were able to communicate just perfectly. I hope my audio came through okay.
I really want to thank Keith. He did yeoman service, he and Will
thank
Allen.
You.
So let's go on to Dick Bertel. Dick, 50
excuse
years.
Excuse me a minute, Richard. I just want to say goodbye. I'll catch you on the other side. My show begins. So you guys, thank you for all your hard work tonight, and I look forward to hearing about it.
Thanks, Robin.
Okay, my thoughts.
Yep.
Mystery. Pluto has always been a mystery planet because it's so far away. We knew relatively little about it. Now we know a great deal, including the entire Pluto system. I think that it's going to become more and more prominent, and we may even see it reinstated as a planet.
That was my feeling. I got a strong feeling from Stern. He's going to argue very effectively it should be a planet. For
I
all
think
those
it,
folks,
is, it is reinstated already. It's just not official yet.
In terms of consciousness, yes.
Yeah, in terms of consciousness.
Yeah, Keith Laney, thoughts?
Well, it was never uninstated to me. It's always Pluto, and it will always remain so. And I would like to thank, I'm not sure if we got any of the mission people listen to us or anybody involved, but, you know, thank them for the wonderful job that they've done in getting this craft there, keeping it up, and then returning us these images, and look forward to much in the future. And for sure, we're going to be doing the most we can with this data that they're sending us.
Thank you, everybody. Robin, Richard, Keith. Keith, I am really pleased that this came off the way it did. I thank you all, one and all, and I will see you in some fashion back on the Dark Matter Digital Network tonight at 7 p.m. Pacific, at 10 p.m. Eastern, and we will have new data from the spacecraft. Stay tuned.
Great show, Rich.